Chapter 11. The Last Song. In December, on the day of the concert with Mark Burner, she was home from court by 6 and hurrying to shower and change her clothes. She heard Jack in the kitchen and called hello to him as she passed on her way to her bedroom. 40 minutes later, she appeared in the hall in a black dress and high shoes. Around her neck, she wore a silver necklace. Jack had put on a record. It was jazz music, Keith Jarrett's Facing You. She paused to listen to it. It was a long time since she had heard it, remembering now how the piano started gently and then gradually grew stronger until it filled the whole room. She knew that Jack was sending her a message with this music. They had listened to it at the beginning of their relationship, those first few days and weeks after her university exams, when he had invited her to spend first one, then many nights in the room which looked out over the Thames. In that room, she had understood that ecstasy was possible and had screamed with joy. When they had finished making love, she had told him that she did not have enough strength left in her bones to ever do it again. But she did, many times. She was young. It was around that time that Jack started trying to get her to play jazz on the piano. He bought her sheet music to learn from, but she did not find it easy. It allowed for too much freedom, too much playing by feeling. Her fingers needed to follow the rules, the notes as they were written. That was why she was studying law, she told her lover. She gave up, but she did learn to enjoy listening, and it was Jarrett she loved above all others. She went along the hall and paused again at the entrance to the sitting room. Jack had lit candles around the room and was standing by the fire with a bottle of expensive wine in his hand. There was a plate of biscuits, fruit and cheese on the low table in front of him. She moved towards him as he poured a glass of wine and gave it to her, then poured another for himself. They raised and touched their glasses. "We haven't got much time." She thought that he meant that they should be leaving to walk to the Great Hall. It was crazy to be drinking before a concert, but she didn't care. She swallowed another mouthful and then followed him to the table. He offered her the plate and she took some cheese. "Who knows how much?" he said. "Not many years. Either we start living again, really living, or we give up and are unhappy for the rest of our lives." This was something he had always believed. Life is short, and we must try to enjoy every moment. She lifted the glass. "To living again." She saw the sudden happiness in his face. "That dress is amazing," he said. "You look beautiful."
"Thank you."
They stared at each other and then went towards each other and kissed. They kissed again. If they didn't have the concert to go to, she wondered how this might end, but her sheet music was behind her on the chaise longue. They slowly moved apart, then lifted their glasses one more time and drank. She held his arm as they walked together to the Great Hall. A crowd of around 150 people waited for them, standing around the room with glasses of wine. They were mostly judges, lawyers, and barristers. For more than 30 years, she had worked with or against them. She moved around, talking to different groups, quickly losing Jack. Friends came up to hug her and wish her luck. It had been a great idea of the organisers to have a party before the concert. A waiter came by with a tray and she took a third glass of wine. Then Mark Burner appeared and waved a finger to warn her that she shouldn't be drinking. He was right, of course. She raised her glass to him and took a mouthful anyway, then put down the glass. She continued speaking to different groups around the hall until, finally, Mark approached her and she followed him to the steps which led to the stage. As she did, she felt a hand on her arm. It was Sherwood Runcie, a barrister from the Moroccan case who wanted to tell her about something interesting which was connected to her. It had been kept out of the newspapers. She leaned towards him to catch his words and, at the same time, saw Mark look back at her impatiently. She thanked Runcie and went to join Mark at the bottom of the steps. They paused there to wait for the audience to take their seats.
"Are you all right?" Mark said as they waited.
"I'm fine. Why?"
"You look pale."
A loud cheer followed as they slowly climbed the steps. She sat down at the piano and he stood next to it. This was followed by silence. Then Mark nodded to her. Immediately, the gentle notes rose from under her fingers. They moved through Berlioz's Villanelle and Lament. Very quickly, the two of them relaxed together as they performed. She loved the falling words, "Ah, sans amour, sans aller sur la mer." This was followed by Mahler, which Mark sang in English rather than German. Her own playing looked after itself. She only needed to be there. The couple knew that they were holding their audience, and their playing grew better and better. The music took Fiona away from herself, but as she played, she suddenly had the feeling that something waited for her when she returned. She would only know what that was when the music finished, and she had to face it. A small mark on a huge view. Perhaps it wasn't there. Perhaps it wasn't true. They finally finished, as if in a dream, and stood side by side. The audience always clapped loudly, but this was louder than usual, and she could see from the look in Mark's eyes that they had played excellently. There followed calls for more, and now she could hear 100 feet hitting the floor. Mark had tears in his eyes, but her smile was stiff now. As she sat back down and bent her head down, she did not look at her partner. She began to play the gentle notes, surprising him, but then she heard him breathe in because he knew it well. He was smiling as he sang.
"In a field by the river, my love and I did stand. And on my leaning shoulder, she laid her snow-white hand. She told me, 'Take life easy, as the grass grows on the weirs.' But I was young and foolish, and am now full of tears."
When they finished, the audience all stood, and there was shouting and whistling. But only Mark Berner stayed on stage. As he made a bow, he looked across at her worriedly. She was walking quickly away, her eyes on her feet. She went down the steps and hurried towards the exit. She found her coat and, not caring about the rain, walked to the apartment as quickly as she could in her high shoes. When she got there, a couple of the candles were still burning. She stood still, her hair wet and flat, and tried to remember a woman's name. So much had happened since she last thought of her. She remembered a face and heard a voice, and then it came back. Marina Green. Fiona took her phone from her handbag. She apologised for calling so late at night.
"Yes," Marina Green said. "It was 4 weeks ago."
She told her the few details she knew and said she was surprised that Fiona had not been told. Fiona remained standing in the same place. The music she had just played was not on her mind. She had forgotten the concert. Two thoughts came into her mind. "Why didn't you tell me? Why didn't you ask for my help?" The answer came back in her own imagined voice. "I did."
She turned and went to the bedroom to find the poem in her bedside table where she had kept it. She went directly to the last lines. God standing in the water, saying that she, the fish, was Satan, and he, Adam, must pay the fine. "And God stood on the water, and he said this to me, 'That fish was the voice of Satan, and you must pay the fine. Her kiss was the kiss of Judas. Her kiss sold my name. May he—'"
She came back to the sitting room and sat on the chaise longue, leaning closer to the words. Knife had been taken out, so had pay, let him, blame, and slain. The word himself was taken out, put in, taken out again. Yes, now she understood. "May he who drowns my cross by his own hand be slain." When she heard the front door open, she didn't turn away, and this was how Jack saw her as he entered the sitting room.
"You were brilliant," he said. "Everyone loved it."
He came back with the rest of the wine and two fresh glasses. He didn't notice how pale she was as he poured wine into hers and gave it to her. Then he went across the room and put the Jarrett record back on. She said, "Jack, not now."
"Of course, after tonight, stupid of me."
She knew that he wanted to get back to where they were before the concert, and she felt sorry for him. Soon he would want to kiss her. He started talking to her about the concert, of how proud he was of her, and what all the people had said about her after she left. She listened and said nothing. Finally, seeing her face, he paused.
"What's wrong?"
"I'm all right."
He suddenly remembered a question he had failed to ask.
"Why did you walk off the stage at the end?"
"That last song, the Sally Gardens, it was too much for me."
He looked like he didn't believe her. He had heard her and Mark do it many times before.
"How?"
he asked. She said, "A memory from the summer." "Yes?" He didn't sound very interested. "A young man played that tune to me on his violin. He was just learning. It was in a hospital. I sang with him. I think we were quite loud. Then he wanted to play it again, but I had to leave."
Jack was not in the mood to play games. She heard the confusion in his voice.
"Start again. Who was this?"
"A very strange and beautiful young man." She spoke quietly. "You remember the boy I visited in hospital? A Jehovah's Witness. Very ill, refusing a transfusion. It was in the newspapers."
If he needed reminding, it was because he had been with Melanie at the time. If he hadn't been, they would have discussed the case.
"I ruled for the hospital to treat him, and he recovered. The judgment had... it had an effect on him. I think he had strong feelings for me."
Jack put down his empty glass. "Go on."
"When I was on circuit, he followed me up to Newcastle, and I..."
She wasn't going to tell him what happened there. And then she changed her mind.
"He walked through the rain to find me, and I did something so stupid. I don't know what I was... I kissed him. I kissed him."
He stepped away from her, but she no longer cared.
"He was the sweetest boy. He wanted to come and live with us."
"Us?"
Jack May had worked in a university all his adult life. He knew that people could do and think different things at the same time, but knowing this could not protect him. She saw the anger in his face.
"He thought I could change his life. I suppose he wanted me to be his teacher. He was so hungry for life, for everything. And I didn't...
So you kissed him, and he wanted to live with you. What are you trying to tell me?
I sent him away.
She shook her head, and for a moment she couldn't speak. Then she looked at Jack. He stood away from her with his feet apart and arms crossed, his face stiff with anger. She could hear the rain beating the window.
So what happened? He asked. Where is he now?
She spoke quietly. I heard it tonight from Runcie. Some weeks ago, his leukemia came back and he was taken into hospital. He refused the transfusion they wanted to give him. That was his decision. He was 18, and there was nothing they could do. He died.
So he died for his faith?
Her husband's voice was cold.
I think he killed himself.
For some seconds, neither of them spoke. They heard voices, laughing and footsteps from outside in the square. People were coming home from the concert.
Were you in love with him, Fiona?
The question destroyed her. She let out a terrible sound, like an animal in pain.
Oh, Jack, he was just a child, a boy, a lovely boy.
Then she began to cry at last, her arms hanging by her sides, while her husband watched. Jack was shocked to see his wife, who was always so self-controlled, be so deeply emotional. She could no longer speak, and the crying would not stop. She could not bear any longer to be seen. She hurried along the corridor towards the bedroom, and the further away from him she got, the louder she cried. She reached the bedroom, and shutting the door hard behind her, fell onto the bed. Half an hour later, when she woke, climbing up from a dream, she had no memory of falling asleep. She thought about Adam falling ill again, returning home to his loving parents, the kindly elders, returning to their faith. Or using it as the perfect cover to destroy himself. May he who drowns my cross by his own hand be slain. She remembered him in the intensive care ward, the pale, thin face, the arms like poles, so ill, but so determined, so full of life. Pages of his poetry on the bed, asking her to stay and play their song again. In court, she offered him, instead of death, all of life and love that lay ahead of him, and protection against his religion. Without faith, how open and beautiful and terrifying the world must have seemed to him. With that thought, she went back into a deeper sleep and woke minutes later to the sound of the rain outside. Would it ever stop? She thought of him walking towards her Newcastle lodgings through the rain, finding a way in the dark. He must have seen the lights in the windows and known she was there. What did he want exactly? And why did he believe he could find it in a woman in her 60th year? A woman who had taken no risks in her life except having a few wild experiences with her cousins many years ago. She should have been glad that he was so interested in her and ready to listen to him and help him. Instead, she had done something which could not be forgiven. She had kissed him, then sent him away. Then ran away herself. Failed to answer his letters. Failed to understand the warning in his poem. How guilty she felt now for her worries about whether someone had seen them. Her mistake was much greater than anything her colleagues could accuse her of. Adam came looking for her, and she offered nothing in religion's place. No protection, even though the Children Act was clear. His interests were the most important thing for her to worry about. How many pages, how many judgments had she written about that? No child is an island. She thought her work ended at the courtroom walls, but how could it? He came to find her wanting what everyone wanted, and what only free-thinking people could give, meaning. She turned in the bed and was surprised to see Jack lying close to her. He reached out a hand and pushed the hair gently from her eyes. She could see his face in the light from the hall.
"I've been watching you sleep," he said.
After a long while, she whispered,
"Thank you."
Then she asked him if he would still love her once she had told him the whole story. It was an impossible question, for he knew almost nothing yet. She suspected he would tell her that she should not feel guilty. He put his hand on her shoulder and pulled her to him.
"Of course I will."
They lay face to face while the rain fell heavily on the city outside. And, as their marriage slowly began again, she told him in a quiet voice of her guilt, of the sweet boy's passion for life, and of her part in his death. Penguin Readers, The Children Act, Ian McEwan, Level 7, retold by Anna Truin, Series Editor Sorrel Pitts, read by Nigel Pilkington. Copyright Penguin Books Limited, 2021.